1290. Stay tuned.
Anyone can make a change, the fear they have the will.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel and I'm your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 10, and on Saturdays at 4. We're brought to you by Montecito Bank and Trust, proudly serving our communities and their financial needs for over 40 years. Pierre LaFon, Wendy Foster, offering fine clothes, good food, and vintage wines. Habitat for Humanity, building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. And CSU Channel Islands, no matter which of their academic programs you choose, you will be at the center of your educational experience. And our first guest today, and we have two guests today, both professors at CSU Channel Islands, is Colleen Delaney, professor of anthropology. Good afternoon, Colleen.
Good afternoon, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. So we're going to talk about some of the things that you're doing involving some of the catastrophes we've had. But let's just step back a minute and take a look at what the anthropology department does at CSU. I understand you have a forensic course. Is this sort of like CSI on television?
Not quite. That's what everybody always thinks. So at CI, we only have an undergraduate major, so we have a very broad-based major where students take courses in all four subfields of anthropology, which includes archaeology, sociocultural anthropology, bioanthropology, and linguistics. So the forensics class is a sub-course within the bioanthropology class, and we've offered that now for 3 times, and the students find it very interesting. They really like that one because they learn it's a cross between archaeology as well as they learn about bones, identifying pathologies or injuries, and then they have a mock crime scene investigation where they try to reconstruct what happened. And they also learn about the biology and the natural events that might affect bodies, and so that you might think it's a murder scene, but in actuality it was an accident. So it's things like that.
We had as a guest two weeks ago a mathematical professor and on the island, they have a collaborative course in working with bat research, and the mathematics department is there to help the students creating a study of bats to understand the mathematics behind it. And so it sounds like there's some collaborative opportunities for you as well with your anthropology focus.
Yes. You mean with the greater community? So we work with the greater community as well as with the national parks. So I've been working out on Santa Rosa Island since 2013 because the cultural resources folks only have one or two people for 5 islands. And so we take the students out there so they can train and using archaeology and anthropological techniques. And then we're also doing service for the national park in order to record historic buildings and re-record prehistoric Chumash sites. So I work with both national parks and state parks. And then, for example, the fire-related stuff than with the public at large.
So, pardon my ignorance, but it sounds like archaeology and anthropology has a lot of intersection. Is that true?
No, that is true. Thanks for pointing that out. In most of the world, archaeology is a separate field, or it's with history because you're studying the prehistory of the local peoples. But given our political background, right, where the dominant political people are from Europe. So here in the United States, anthropology is the study of people, and so we include archaeology into that because it is the study of people. But it's not history in many ways because it's the archaeology here in California is the Chumash, right? The Chumash and their ancestors have been here far longer than Euro-Americans. So in the United States, archaeology is a subfield of anthropology.
So in your study of people, have you done any research on politicians?
not yet, but actually one of my subfields, what I'm interested in is what we call sociopolitical inequality, because for over 100,000 years, humans were egalitarian. And it's only been in the last 8 to 10,000 years that we start seeing, I guess, what you would call politicians. So you start seeing the haves and the have-nots and people getting designated roles. And I'm interested in why that occurs. Why would people give up their egalitarianism to listen to somebody else and have somebody else tell them what to do?
Yeah, I mean, that's a question that I've been asking for the last 2 years, but I guess maybe I should take an anthropology course. How did you get involved? Were you 3 years old and deciding between being a fireman and being an anthropologist? How did you get interested in this?
That's true. Yeah, I'm one of the many who actually, for me, it was fourth grade. We used to always visit museums and parks when I was a kid. And I, at that time, I was in East Texas and we visited a brand new state park. It was a Caddo site with mounds. And then I also visit a Pompeii exhibit where you see the plaster casts of the bodies that were in the cavities. And so ever since then, I was interested in archaeology. And I went to, I'm dating myself here, West Germany as a foreign exchange student in the late 1980s. And so I visited all sorts of sites, Roman villas and a Neolithic site in England. And so I decided when I came back from my senior year of high school that I wanted to study archaeology. And I've been doing it ever since.
So where did you go to school?
Undergraduate was a small liberal arts college called Beloit College in Wisconsin, which is well known for its anthropology program. And I got my master's and my PhD from UCLA.
And the interesting thing I would imagine for you is that archaeology and anthropology, it seems, has gone from, you know, a science that, you know, was buried in the dusty pages of the library to where a lot of people find it exciting now. It may be because of all the TV shows. But the science seems to be getting people's interest.
Yes. So it's interesting because many people, they think, oh, Indiana Jones or Bones. And of course, the real thing is it's much more tedious and you know, you have to have a lot more patience. But yes, now that we have these new techniques where we can actually figure out pigment or, you know, the chemical analysis of pigments or figuring out, looking at bone chemistry and figuring out that even though somebody might have been buried in San Francisco, they were actually raised up in the Sierra Nevada. So it's really exciting with the scientific advances that we've had in the last 15 to 20 years.
So when a student gets a degree in anthropology, what are the career opportunities?
Anthropology is one of those fields where really the sky's the limit. So we have the subset of students who really, such as me, who know I want to go to grad school, you know, I want to be a professional archaeologist. But we have students who end up in museums, they work in state parks or park rangers. And then anything, because the anthro is all about the study of humans, so any job that deals with humans, whether it be broadcasting or human resources, really it is applicable. So we had one student who worked for a well-known restaurant chain throughout the United States when she was getting her degree, and they let her interview all the front staff, all the wait staff and the bussers across the country. And that was her senior thesis. And then after she was done, they liked her work so much that they asked her to rewrite their employee handbook for all the front staff for the entire country. So, you know, we were really proud of that. So here, because we really push applied anthropology. So it's the background theory and knowledge, but also how can we actually apply this knowledge to helping people improve their lives today?
That's really interesting because one of the things about CI that I find really impressive is how many kids actually get jobs in the field that they choose. There's a very high degree of academic rigor, but there's also a recognition that there needs to be skills that the graduate has that actually can make them employable.
Yes, that's what we strive for.
Yeah, and you know, the work that you do in Santa Rosa not only gives them an opportunity to do something useful, it must be fun, huh? Getting out there?
Yes, it's fun. And our goal in anthropology is to have every student out on the islands before they graduate. And Santa Rosa in particular, because it's further out, it's a game changer for so many students. Because, I mean, I had one student in particular, but we laughed because he's the example for all. He'd never been on a boat. He'd never seen a whale. He'd never seen a shooting star. He'd never seen the Milky Way, right? So all these firsts, and that's one thing that happens when the students go out there. They have a completely new experience, right? Turn off the phones and really experience the world around them.
Hey, I have never seen the Milky Way.
Well, you have to join us out on Santa Rosa one day.
I went there, but it was during the day. Is that the problem? Is that why I couldn't?
That's the problem.
So there is a practical aspect to your work that is really helping all of us, and that's your work dealing with the catastrophes that we've had in Ventura and in Santa Barbara over the last year. So tell us a little bit about the volunteer work you're doing.
Right. So this actually started, I'm working with a group of volunteers who are trying to recover what we call cremains. And cremains are the previously cremated remains of loved ones. So if your parent died, your grandparent died, and you had them on an urn on, you know, on the mantle or in your office. And so oftentimes, as we know, especially with the Thomas Fire, things happen so quickly that folks don't have time to, you know, think about what they're going to retrieve. And so often the cremains are frequently left behind. And this came to the fore actually last year. So my colleagues who started this project worked up in the Tubbs Fire and the Carr Fire up in Northern California last year. And they had a family who approached them, the archaeologists, because they were so devastated that they'd left their loved one behind. And so the archaeologists consulted with the Institute for Canine Forensics. And then so it's a team, and then they started doing that last year. And I'm friends with some of these archaeologists through the Society for California Archaeology. And so when the Hill and Woolsey Fire happened, I contacted them to see about if they were planning on coming down. And so I joined the volunteer team. So it's an all volunteer effort. No one is paid to do this, but you know, something we want to do because as archaeologists, we have a kind of an odd, unique skill set. And so in many ways, we can't give back. But in cases such as these fires and in the World Trade Center bombing, archaeologists and bioanthropologists have actually been able to step forward and at least try to, you know, provide some comfort to the family members.
So it's scientifically possible to search through ashes and determine which are human remains and which are just ashes?
Yes, because the human remains, it's frequently the that's the bones, right? So the bones are different than other organic material. So it leaves a different texture and or a different color. So it does depend on the situation of the particular house and the fire, but yes. So
and you can you can tell between an animal and a human, too?
That's a little more difficult depending on, you know, the status and how the remains are. But the dogs are trained specifically for humans as opposed to other animals.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. Programs and workshops in classroom, online, with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
The Central Coast may seem laid back, but when it's time to work, no one works harder, including the bank that's grown up here. Montecito Bank and Trust offers customized lending and banking for all businesses, big and small. It's harder than offering one-size-fits-all solutions, but it's the right thing to do. And here, getting things right is a way of life. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, using innovative social-emotional learning and character building to help teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Colleen Delaney, a professor of anthropology at CSU Channel Islands. And right before the break, we were talking about cremains, the recovery of human remains from a fire. And I have to ask this question, although I'm not sure it's appropriate, but what about in the case of in Santa Barbara during the mud flows, there are still, I think, two or three missing bodies. Is there any way to not just look for remains that were cremated, but remains that were as a result of the fire itself?
Yes, they've been able to train dogs, again, for living scent, and it's slightly different between whether or not it's search and rescue or whether it's someone who's been deceased. But yes, they do, and this particular group of people, the Institute for Canine Forensics, that's how they started out. They started out doing search and rescue and searching for the remains of people who've been deceased in disasters. So that is still possible in Santa Barbara with the mud flows, but it's issues with the scent for the dogs, right? So if there's too much debris or if things have passed too long, then they might not be able to pick up the scent.
And I see here there's a note that they found Amelia Earhart. Congratulations.
Yes, I was not a part of that project. But, yeah, they were part of the project that was trying to locate the remains of a plane and then possibly her remains as well.
Right. So when do students come into the school interested or dedicated to this, or do they sort of evolve into majoring in anthropology?
Right. Anthropology tends to be what we call a discovery major because most students have never heard of anthropology. So we do get, you know, a small percentage, maybe 20%, who come in knowing that that's what they want to do, in particular archaeology and bioanthropology, so the forensics. But most of the other students we tend to capture through general education courses, right, or through a special topics course that they saw an announcement for.
And is the anthropology and archaeology departments aligned, or is it two separate departments?
Right. We're together. So they're, archaeology here at CI is a subfield of anthropology.
And the number of kids, number of students in the department?
We're small but mighty, we like to think. Our program actually is only 5 years old. We're in our sixth year right now. So we already have about 75 majors. And we already have our first group of students who've already gone through graduate school. So we have several that have master's degrees and are now working out in the public. And some who just go straight to jobs. That's the great thing about archaeology in particular, is that we have students that are employed straight out of college, that they're able to get gainful employment.
And the opportunities, what are the opportunities for someone? Besides education to be a teacher, is there a robust job market?
Yes. Yes, especially for what we call applied anthropology. So that's the sociocultural in particular, because they know interviewing skills, they learn statistics, they can interview people. So frequently they're brought in by companies to analyze a workplace dynamics, or, right, so for things like that, or just simply, again, I think as I mentioned earlier, jobs, anything dealing with people. So human HR, so human resources, radio announcers, things like that, things where you can relate to people. Anthropology is a plus, because we understand that folks come from different backgrounds, and so there's different ways, different knowledge that they have, and different ways of thinking. And so, for example, our medical anthropology class, that is our most popular class, and the majority of the students are health sciences and nursing students, because you have to be aware that many different cultures have different views of disease and illness. So if you don't understand that and don't respect that, then you're not going to be able to work with them to improve their health or to find out what's wrong with them, because they view things differently. So some cultures, for example, don't have a view of germs. They don't have a germ theory. And so you need to work with them in order to help reduce communicable diseases.
What happened to, those 1930 movies where you see someone with a pith helmet on and a brush, in a dig, dusting off bones? Or is that still part of the job description?
Yeah, some folks like me, archaeologists, we go out there, but not quite like that. We love Indiana Jones, right? I'm one of the ones who loved him, but, really he's a pot hunter and, and completely disregarded the local indigenous people. So today it's much more collaborative. So we work, for example, I've worked with the Chumash, right? So we work with local people, we work with other stakeholders, as well as development companies. So we try to bring everybody together to figure out the best ways to preserve the archaeology and also to learn from the past.
And you're very respectful. When I went to Santa Rosa Island 2 years ago, I was looking at a construction site and it had been halted because you found a burial site apparently, and the bones needed to be reburied before you could continue with the construction of the building, which is, you know, being, you know, sensitive to the people who, the indigenous people.
Right. Yeah. So in the past, I'm the first to admit archaeologists didn't do that. So that's one of the, you know, things where we've grown as a profession, and understanding the importance of consulting, right, with the descendants of
The first thing they did was take the archaeological finds, put them in boxes, and ship them to Yale.
Right.
I went to Machu Picchu a year ago, and I read the book before I went about, you know, what happened there 100 years ago. It was really outrageous. The looting that took national looting that took place, which, you know, is, I think, changing now. I think people are much more aware of the damage that can be done by taking finds and just taking them out of the culture that they were found.
Right, and we're trying to respect, and part of it, archaeology is understanding the context. So yes, where things were found and what they're found with is equally as important as just a single artifact.
So, do you work with any particular department? One of the things about CSU that really has impressed me is the collaborative nature of departments. So, do you guys work with other departments that, you know, are interested in, because of a particular, whether it's biology, whether it's mathematics, anything that, you know, art, you know, things that you can find a way of working together on?
Yes, so it really depends on the project. So, for example, I've worked with Dr. Blake Gillespie, a chemistry professor, analyzing nutritional value of a native plant called Dicholastemma capitatum, which the Chumash used extensively. So he's helping me with the project, understanding, you know, the nutritional value of the plant. I've worked with geologists at Cal State Northridge, and my other anthropology colleagues work closely with our environmental science and resource management faculty. So Jaime Matera and Jennifer Perry are work with projects, and we co-teach classes. We have two classes that are actually cross-listed with environmental science. So it really depends on, you know, a particular professor's interests and what project they're working on.
Well, thank you so much, Colleen, for being here and for all you do. You know, I think the next time I come to campus, I want to go and look at your dinosaur exhibit. You have one, right? You know, it's 50 feet tall.
Not yet, but we have a nice exhibit on Santa Rosa Island, so right, please come by and join us one
right
time.
Well, thank you, Colleen. And for our listeners, the second half of the show, we're going to have Sean Anderson, who is going to set a record today. He's been on, this is the third time, and I believe in 6.5 years, he's the only guest that we've had three times. So you've been listening to, and will continue to listen to, AHA Presents About Education on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back.
Celebrating 50 years of serving loyal regular guests and first-time visitors, the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli invites you to enjoy their huge selection of fresh-baked sweets, cookies, carrot cake, muffins, and the famous farm cake, granola, Oreo popcorn, wine cake, homemade soups, and the popular fresh juice bar. Or get a coffee drink or fresh-squeezed juice and peruse the famous wall of greeting cards at the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli. Open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. CSU Channel Islands is affordable and financial aid is available with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
What's that?
This? The newest online business banking around.
Can you initiate wires and approve transfers?
Yes.
Pay bills?
Check.
Cash management?
Of course.
All business, all online, all on your phone?
You bet. My computer, too. It's Montecito Bank and Trust's new business online banking. It works as hard as I do.
Huh. Montecito Bank and Trust.
You got it. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, Improving Attitude, Creating Social Harmony, Bridging the Achievement Gap for Teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here now with Dr. Sean Anderson. Sean, I think I did not mention your name properly before.
It's all good. It's okay.
Professor of Environmental Science at CSU Channel Islands. So I have to say that every time I turn the key news on Channel 3 here in Santa Barbara, when there is a discussion of a fire or a debris flow, you're on.
I'm the positive guy. I'm the happy guy.
You're the happy guy. You're all over the place. So tell us about some of the work and research you've been doing as a result of the Woolsey Fire.
So we're still spinning up a lot of our Woolsey Fire stuff. We started about 2 weeks ago, but things are still picking up. One of the things that's always a challenge for us in the wake of these disasters is we don't want to get in the way and cause additional problems. So in the case of Woolsey, a ton of infrastructure was damaged in the particularly the coastal corridors that go from essentially the San Fernando Valley down to the Pacific Ocean through the Santa Monica Mountains, through Canaan Road, Encinal Canyon, these places. And that fire went so fast, it torched a lot of the bridges and also a lot of the telephone poles and power lines. So actually, when you drive there, it looks like it's okay, but actually many of the roads are still shut down because those power poles are so burned, they're still in danger of coming down. So the consequence, we haven't gotten to all of our sites. We've started to get to some of our sites. What we've been doing is we're working with the city of Agoura Hills to help them understand mud flows and to map the hillsides around the city of Agoura Hills. We're doing our wildlife monitoring that we've done after the last several fires, including the Thomas Fire, et cetera. So there we're walking around looking for critters that were impacted by the fire. We're also doing a series of road-based surveys that we've been doing for 13 years to look at the relative impact on wildlife. And then we're doing work looking at what's been going on with the physical environment. So in particular, pollutants, aerial pollutants, stuff in the water, et cetera. And there, one of our newest areas of research has been in looking at microplastics. So looking at not just the typical soot and things that are around that people might inhale, but also starting to look at some of the novel pollutants that are coming off of our built landscapes.
And when you say we, that includes students.
Of course, yeah. So these are my fellow professors, but the bulk of our workforce are our undergraduates. So our undergraduates, our program in particular, our Environmental Science and Resource Management program, is very, very applied, very, very hands-on. So my students know how to fly drones. We're doing the mapping by flying our aerial robots, our drones. They know how to collect water samples. They know how to test for microplastics, all these things. So they do those routinely in classes and in independent research projects. So when we have something like an oil spill or like a wildfire, we can pop up really quickly and jump on and collect data and provide feedback to different agencies or different folks. And then also we can collect our longitudinal data so that we can have a sort of a mile high view as to what these wildfires are doing to our people and our landscapes. We're also doing public opinion polling and looking at the socioeconomic aspects of these fires.
It's ironic, but these catastrophes are providing a wonderful opportunity for your students to get firsthand experience.
It's true. Yeah. So I drive around, I do my roadkill surveys, and I get very excited. I'm very morbid. I get very excited when I see a dead critter, and then I have to check myself. It's like, oh, man, it's a dead critter. But yes, it is an interesting profession to be in, shall we say.
So, when the Thomas Fire hit, it was clear to me why it was spreading so fast. It's up in the mountains, and some of the areas hadn't burned for 100 years. Mm-hmm. But when I naively look at where the Woolsey Fire was, it had housing developments. And usually you think of a fire in a suburban area as, you know, the fire department comes and puts the fire out. Why was it so out of control?
So actually, the thing that happened up in Paradise, the thing that happened during Thomas, the thing that happened during Woolsey, it was all essentially the same phenomenon. So in this case, it didn't so much matter if it was wildlands or it was the wildlands urban interface or if it was more of a suburban, a built environment. So it's three parts as to what's going on with our modern wildfire scene. The first thing, the most important thing, is that we started in 1905 when Gifford Pinchot and Teddy Roosevelt founded the U.S. Forest Service. We started a policy of active fire suppression. So fire is a natural part of our ecology, natural part of Southern California. But we were actively putting out fires because we thought they were wasteful. We thought they would take away the timber and the forage and stuff that our cattle would need. That was an ignorant view, a too short-term focused view, but that's allowed for a bunch of fuels to build up. The next thing that's come along is we've really allowed a lot of development into very burnable landscapes. So whether that's foothills around Ojai, Thousand Oaks, wherever we want to talk about. And so that sets the stage to allow fire to be really problematic in a built environment. And that's sort of the ongoing, those two challenges are the most important ones. Those are the big, big things. But then we've taken and we've put on the salad dressing, if you will, of climate change. So we've added all this weirdness that is drought. So when the Woolsey fire broke out, it was 6%, 5%, 4% relative humidity. It was crazy dry. And perhaps the biggest thing with these recent fires, including the firestorms last October up in 2017 up in the San Francisco Bay Area, we have these very, very strong winds. So in our part of California, we call those Santa Ana winds. We typically historically have Santa Ana winds. They go for a day or 2 days, but in the Thomas fire, it was 2 weeks of solid blowing. Same thing in the Camp fire. We had these very, very strong winds, and in the Woolsey, we had these very strong winds. So, the fire that probably, Neil, you have in your head is one where the flames are essentially mostly going upwards, they're moving in one direction, but they're mostly going towards the sky. In these initial outbreak periods, the flames are going much closer to horizontal. They're more like 45 degrees or even a lower angle. And so they're more like a blowtorch jumping across the landscape. So for example, in Paradise, where all those folks lost their homes and lives and everything. If you see the footage now, there's of course a lot of destroyed homes, and there's a lot of destroyed trees, but there's also some living trees. So the fire was not hopscotching along necessarily the tops of all the trees. It was blasting like a blowtorch along the ground. And so it doesn't matter if that's in Malibu or if that's in Paradise or wherever, stuff is going to burn. And even though we think of our houses as really being not as burnable as, say, the wildlands surrounding them, our houses are made up of wood, the rafters are made up of wood, and that stuff will go when it gets enough heat.
When the Thomas fire was over, there was a lot of research and inspections taking place, including mm-hmm. your group. Did we learn anything from the Thomas fire that could have helped or did help with the Woolsey fire?
Sure, absolutely. So a classic example, one of the classic things we learned. So I actually grabbed this and put this on my YouTube page. I thought it was so interesting. But when we had Ventura County in particular, Santa Barbara as well, but in particular Ventura County has made huge strides. We were always pretty good, but especially in the wake of the Thomas fire, we've really done a lot of lessons learned and talk to technical folks, talk to the general public. What did you know? What didn't you know? How can we make that better? So let's jump forward to the Woolsey fire. When you were looking at the newscasts on day two, on day three, et cetera, what you would see, whether it was national news, local news, you would see this map of the fire perimeter, which comes from the fire authorities. And so that was clear. Here's the fire. And then you would see evacuation notices. For the first several days, all you saw were the evacuation overlaid on the map, the evacuation polygons of Ventura County. And there would be no polygons in Los Angeles County because, again, the Woolsey fire straddled Ventura-Los Angeles County, the border. And it was very strange. What was going on there was Ventura County, very forward-thinking, very proactive. You go to any of the VC alerts or any of the Ventura County preparedness or emergency response pages. And there they had all these fantastic maps in easily consumable format. You could throw it on Google Earth. You could open it in a browser and you could see these polygons and, oh my gosh, I need to evacuate my house. I shouldn't be there. When it came to Los Angeles County, Los Angeles doesn't have that. Instead, Los Angeles has, evacuate from north of road, blah, 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 and then south of this and then east of that. And so it's not that LA County weren't interested, but they didn't have the user-friendly information to say, get your butt out of here now. And so that's another barrier that makes it harder for people to understand that they really need to get out and that there are real dangers in their local area. So there's all kinds of examples, but that I think is the most visceral, the most obvious one to start with.
You've been listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafond's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafond and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. Programs and workshops in classroom, online, with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
The Central Coast may seem laid back, but when it's time to work, no one works harder, including the bank that's grown up here. Montecito Bank and Trust offers customized lending and banking for all businesses, big and small. It's harder than offering one-size-fits-all solutions, but it's the right thing to do. And here, getting things right is a way of life. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, helping teens achieve goals, surmount challenges, stop bullying, and communicate and listen effectively. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Dr. Sean Anderson, Professor of Environmental Science at CSUCI. And before the break, we were talking about the difference between the warning system in Ventura versus LA, and then I think we have to mention the difference between both of them and Paradise's evacuation. If the newspapers are accurate, you know, that was really irresponsible what happened there.
Yes, yeah, so you cut out there for a second. I didn't hear the full question, but yeah, it sounded like the evacuation. So the evacuations are a real thing. So the evacuations are a key part of what's becoming obvious. So, for example, Paradise knew. Well, I should be careful here, but in the planning, so we had a fire in Paradise in the early 90s, and that caused all these problems and everything. And the elected representatives from the town got together and they said, hey, how are we going to do this better? The federal government actually intensively logged some of the area behind the town to take out some of the dead timber and all that kind of stuff. So all these things that people say we should have done, we actually did do in this case. The one thing we didn't do, though, we didn't really take the evacuation planning seriously. So the roads, for example, the main road coming out of Paradise could support, on a morning, could take a couple thousand vehicles over the course of the morning. They knew that in an evacuation, they would have to get out, thousands and thousands of people over the course of, half hour, 45 minutes. And they just decided their response would be to not evacuate everybody at once. They would have a phased evacuation where this part of the town, we'd say go first. These other guys would hang out for an hour or two. Then we'd have them go. Essentially a very unrealistic evacuation schedule. And we saw what happened. We saw these people in their cars, evacuating their cars as the fire was overtaking them, et cetera. In the case of Malibu, it came very, very fast. And it came down these corridors. And we saw the first ever usage in California of so-called contra flow. So our friends in the Gulf Coast, our friends that live near hurricane areas where we work on hurricanes as well, they're very used to this. So the idea is, oh my God, a hurricane is coming, a natural disaster is coming. We want everybody out of the region, everybody out of the city. All of the road beds become away from the city. So the normally, right-hand side of the road is out, but then also the left-hand side, all the traffic flows out, so-called contra flow to the normal flow of traffic. For the start of the Woolsey Fire in Malibu, we were using PCH as a regular road, so people were driving both ways. Rapidly, it got impacted. Rapidly, people started going bumper to bumper. Rapidly, people went nowhere very quickly. And people started abandoning their cars and all this and that, then you get the additional challenge of physically blocking the road with abandoned vehicles. But after about 2 hours or so, the authorities finally said, you know what, we just got to get everybody out. So they flipped all the lanes of PCH in Malibu to be heading south into LA. And that greatly helped. And that was what allowed people that still had gas in their cars and everything to get out. So there's all kinds of lessons we can learn here. But fundamentally, it's about getting people out. One of the stories that happened was, so I'm always in trouble with my family because whenever these disasters break out, I'm always away. So when the Springs Fire happened, I was with my son at Olivas Adobe in downtown Ventura. When the Woolsey Fire happened, I was with my students at a conference in San Diego. And so, so all kinds of, interesting family dynamics happen in that context, shall we say. But what happened with our house is my wife tried it. So our school was evacuated. We live about 7 minutes away from our campus in the Woolsey Fire. My wife left campus, went up to our house, and was having a hard time getting into our house. And so the idea was everybody has to get out of here. Everybody has to get out of here. Even from our campus, even from our CSCCI campus, very, you know, well-regulated, the parking is out on the perimeter, et cetera. The first folks that went to leave got out pretty quickly. But once folks waited 15, 20 minutes, even 20, 25 minutes, there was huge traffic migration problems then. So it took some people, you know, if you're leaving normally, it would take five minutes to drive off and be off the campus. Some folks were taking an hour, hour and a half to get off. So this is a non-trivial thing. It was laid most bare probably with what happened at Pepperdine. So Pepperdine University is in Malibu, and they have had a policy for over two decades of so-called shelter in place. And we see this across Southern California where different folks want to do a development and folks come in and look and go, ooh, that's really hard to get out of there, or it's hard to get fire trucks in or whatever. And so the assumption has been, oh, we'll do what's so-called shelter in place. So if there is a fire or disaster, you stay in your house. And that seems to make sense in terms of when the developers are proposing, these developments and all this and that, and it sort of satisfies people. But it's a way different thing when you have, 60-mile-an-hour flames running towards you to just say shelter in place. In the case of Pepperdine, that was their initial thing. They said, everybody stay on campus. Some folks said, actually, we need to get folks out of here. So they got some buses. They took students to Zuma Beach. These are the famous pictures where you saw all these folks with llamas on the beach and horses on the beach. Everybody went to the water. So the students went there, and they stayed. So it was really smoky, but they weren't in danger of burning up. They're on the sand, and if for some reason flames did come right up to them, they could jump in the water. After a little bit, and when the fires camped down a little bit, the authorities at Pepperdine said, "Okay, what we need to do is we need to get these folks back." So that they took the folks off the beach, took them back to their nearby campus, put them in their dorms, and said, "We're sheltering in place." And so there's a lot of dramatic videos that people might have seen with students sort of poking their heads out of their dorms and shooting video. Well, one of his friends was at Pepperdine and as a student at Pepperdine. And he said, this is ridiculous. We got to get out of here. The administration says, no. The policy is shelter in place. He said, I just got to get out of here. So we went and jumped in his truck and started driving up Las Virgenes, Malibu Canyon, the road there that goes from PCH to the San Fernando Valley. And he almost died. So when he was driving on this road, there was fire on the right-hand side of the canyon, fire on the left-hand side of the canyon. This is a two-lane road at this point. And he said that the flames were licking the side of his truck. He got out, but had he left another 4 or 5 minutes later, he would not have gotten out. So these shelter in place things are problematic at a planning stage, but once we're already in this fire and the fire is coming, in many cases that is a safer thing if your evacuation route is blocked. the people that have died, a lot of people that died in Paradise, unfortunately, the few folks that died during the Woolsey fire, they died in their cars trying to evacuate.
So the story you just told, it doesn't give me an answer. It's like it works until it doesn't work.
That's right.
And so it's really, if you talk about, you know, what emergency planners have to plan for, there's no clear solution. If you're living in a place that can have fires, there's a lot of unknowns, and you really can't rely on someone with irrefutable knowledge to get you out of there.
This is that very, very true. So there's two levels there. There's the level at the County Board of Supervisors, the long-term planning. Those are the places we need to really have some serious conversations about, do we want this development to go in? But increasingly what we're finding, what Paradise tells us, and maybe what Woolsey tells us, is that just simply planning for the next development, that's maybe not enough. The existing world that we have was not built for a climate-changed world, for a world of a gazillion billion people. And so what we might, the most prudent thing to do might be to actually remove some houses from some of these areas and some of the most vulnerable areas. So what does that mean? That means a couple things. That means either much more vigorous defense of the structures and the homes, much more costly defense, or it means maybe we're going to, you know, essentially eminent domain or some other mechanism come and say, you know what, we're going to buy out these 10 homeowners in this particular back of this box canyon because we don't think we can save them, and this shelter in place is maybe not the best thing. I mean, when it actually happens, you know, it's what the firefighters have. You know, it's what Pepperdine has. We got a shelter in place. So those two different things. It's uncomfortable conversations we're having. The other thing is because we've not dealt with taking these threats seriously, the costs are going up. And as expensive as it would be to maybe buy out some homeowners or buy out some developments or something, that's going to be way, 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 way cheaper than waiting 10 years, 15 years and doing it then.
Unfortunately, we see in Houston building again in exactly the same place that flooded in the last flood.
Yes.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education, and we'll be right back with our final segment.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a 4-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a 4-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. CSU Channel Islands is affordable and financial aid is available with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
What's that?
This? The newest online business banking around.
Can you initiate wires and approve transfers?
Yes.
Pay bills?
Check.
Cash management?
Of course.
All business, all online, all on your phone.
You bet. My computer, too. It's Montecito Bank and Trust's new business online banking. It works as hard as I do.
Huh. Montecito Bank and Trust.
You got it. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens manage their emotions, support their peers, and serve their community. I'm Neil Kreisel, and I'm here with Dr. Sean Anderson, Professor of Environmental Science at CSU Channel Islands. For both Ventura and Santa Barbara, what's your greatest concern this winter? It's raining right now, so
yeah.
I would imagine fire is not a big concern. Or is it? So what's the thing that you stay up at night other than watching late night television?
Other than grading all my papers that I have to do because campus is shut down for 2 weeks. Other than that, sure. It's the mud flows, it's the mud slides kind of stuff. I'd say there's two things here. There's immediately it's these hillsides that have been laid bare either from the Thomas Fire or from these recent Woolsey and Hill fires. And the possibility, like we had in Montecito, of everything is primed to go, and it's just essentially the luck of the draw if we get an intensive downpour in one particular small watershed or not. So that's a big worry. I'd say another one, though, is the chronic. I think sometimes we get so enamored of these very striking images and the horrible death tolls and things of that, which obviously capture our attention, but for me, the other part of these disasters, whether it's a hurricane or an earthquake or whatever, it's sort of the chronic, the day in, the day out impact on our society. So obviously, you lose your home, and that's a dramatic thing, or God forbid, some family member or friend, that's a horrible, horrible thing. The TV cameras are there, the newspapers are there, and they're there for a week or two, then they go away. But the legacy of responding to this destruction is a long one. So we've been doing a public opinion poll surveying for about 13 years, Santa Barbara, Ventura, Los Angeles counties. And so every fall we survey about between about 1,000 and 1,500 people. And for example, this year we asked people from impacted by the Thomas Fire and associated adjacent fires, did it affect you? Did it affect your home? Did it affect your business? 36% of folks said that they weren't impacted by fire. 45% said they had significant initial impact, and 15% said they're still having significant impact. So that's, again, that's across all of our counties. And so that 15% is a huge number. So that's folks that are either still trying to rebuild, those are folks that are still trying to restart their business, and that's what I get really worried about is this sort of chronic day in, day out, and the impact that has on relationships, the impact that has on tension in all kinds of ways. So I'm really worried about those effects. As we have more and more of these disasters, when we have one disaster, our capacity to be resilient and bounce back is strong. But when we have the Thomas Fire, then the Woolsey Fire, then God forbid some other thing this summer, another, eventually we start to get fatigued. And for those folks that are dealing with these long-term recovery trajectories, that's tough.
And we only have 90 seconds. We only have 60 seconds left. But have you taken a look at the mountainside? Is there a significant growth in chaparral yet, or is it still
no? It's still mostly bare. There's some grasses, but it's not the holding capacity we'd like from a mature canopy.
But I think it's good that they've done a really good job in cleaning out the debris basins. And
the
last rain, nothing happened, which it's really good that they did that. And I guess the last thing that we should note is that one of the things we should do is buy vacuum cleaners and vacuum up the forest floors. I guess that's...
Rake America great again.
Rake America great again. I know. You can't make this stuff up. Sean, thank you so much. You're always a great guest. And thank you so much for all you do for both communities, for Santa Barbara and for Ventura. You've been listening to AHA Presents About Education. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.